The following is a presentation of the American College of Osteopathic Internists.
Welcome to this recording of the American College of Osteopathic Internists Internal Medicine Board Review Course. The course was held in Baltimore at the Marriott Waterfront Hotel on May 8th through 12th, 2019. The course featured nationally known speakers covering a wide variety of topics of importance to the internist preparing for initial certification or for recertification in the specialty of internal medicine. Systemic allergic disorders, immunodeficiency, and immunoglobulin disorders is presented by Dr. Brian Martin.
All right, thanks for hanging in. This is hard. I know you're tired. I know. Our objectives remain the same. We're going to pass the boards. We're really going to spend some time on anaphylaxis and anaphylactoid reactions, and I'll tell you why as we go along. So our first patient's a 45-year-old woman who goes to lunch with her friends. While eating, she develops GI upset, dizziness, shortness of breath, and hives. Her friends drive her to your nearby clinic, probably passing an emergency room along the way, right? Your nurse gets history of sudden onset of GI upset, dizziness, shortness of breath, and hives while eating a shrimp salad. The patient now has audible wheezing, tachycardia, and a blood pressure of 110 over 60. What is your initial response? Do we take a detailed history? Do we ask if he has a history of certain medical diseases? Do we give her a nebulized beta agonist, 50 milligrams of oral diphenhydramine, or 0.3 ml of IM epinephrine? And of course, we're going to give her IM epinephrine. The initial response to anaphylaxis is IM epinephrine at a dose of 0.01 milligram per kilogram up to a max dose of 0.5 milligrams. Those who have hair as gray as mine were initially taught that you should give adrenaline sub-Q, and that it was changed from sub-Q to IM. Look for sub-Q as a distractor. It is IM epinephrine. You'll typically have the choice of an auto-injectable epinephrine, as time is of the essence, and time taking and drawing up epinephrine from a vial is wasted. And again, expect subcutaneous epinephrine to be a distractor. We know that epinephrine is a mixed alpha and beta adrenergic receptor agonist that treats anaphylaxis symptoms by alleviating allergen-induced inflammation and physiologic effects. On the alpha side, we get vasoconstrictor, we reverse vasodilatation, we alleviate hypotension, reduce erythema, urticaria, and angioedema. On the beta side, we get dilated bronchial airways, increased force of myocardial contraction, and we can then help with the heart rate. So the distractors, take a detailed history, blah, blah, blah. Well, obviously we want the detailed history, but when we treat anaphylaxis, remember it is a two-phase treatment. The first thing you have to do is save the patient's life. Acute care. Then you go into the specific care so that you try to figure out what it was that caused the anaphylaxis so that you can prevent another event in the future. So it's important after we treat her acute anaphylaxis. And the history of medical diseases such as asthma, diabetes, or heart disease, this will be a specific testing point. And this is something that's been discussed ad nauseum in the literature. Epinephrine is indicated for the emergent treatment of anaphylaxis, regardless of the underlying medical condition. So they are going to throw at you a 75-year-old with known coronary artery disease with anaphylaxis. And you're supposed to quiver and say, oh, I don't know what to do in this case, because you're afraid of causing cardiac issues by giving epinephrine to somebody with coronary artery disease. You give epinephrine because the anaphylaxis is more dangerous than the underlying cardiac disease. You may precipitate a heart attack. That may happen. I've done that once. It can happen. But you've saved the patient's life so that you can send him or her to the coronary care unit and take care of them. So another distractor is to give nebulized beta agonist. Well, she's wheezing. Everybody wants to jump on nebulized beta agonist in a wheezer. And why it might help the wheezing, it's not going to help the rest of her signs and symptoms. And delay in providing epinephrine is the primary cause of increased morbidity and mortality in anaphylaxis. Beta agonists are a great second-line treatment. They are not a first-line treatment. Give 50 milligrams of oral diphenhydramine. This is the answer that almost every emergency room physician in the United States is going to give, because that's what patients get in the emergency room. But it's not the right answer. You know, they say if it's an allergic reaction, we give antihistamine. Antihistamines are a good second-line therapy. They're not a primary. They can help with hives. They take too long. They're adjunctive treatment for anaphylaxis. It's epinephrine. So IM epinephrine is the treatment of choice. And the secondary treatments may include oxygen, IV fluids, beta agonists, antihistamines, glucocorticoids, and glucagon. What you get in the United States all too often is corticosteroids and Benadryl. It's not even antihistamines. It's Benadryl. And so there's a focus right now in the literature, and there has been since 2014, on the fact that patients aren't getting epinephrine in the emergency room. I think anaphylaxis is fair game. With a five-year history in the literature of people banging our heads against the wall saying, give epinephrine for anaphylaxis, I think it's a great test question or series of questions. What about the more detailed history? Don't you want to know what she ate? Don't you want to know what the suspect foods are? Of course you do, but not yet. Underlying medical conditions I went through, don't delay the epinephrine. Now, once the acute anaphylaxis is treated, then it's important to help the patient prepare for possibility of a future episode. Try to identify the antigen so that they can avoid it. Identify cofactors. Now, asthma and diabetes come into are important. Provide auto-injectable epinephrine, explain to the patient how to use it, and provide a written anaphylaxis plan and education. Now, this is the 2014 European guidelines for anaphylaxis. I want to use them momentarily because of some specific ideas, but I really want you to look at the green headline on that's beside it. Anaphylaxis, underdiagnosed, underreported, and undertreated. And I always add, underappreciated. What happened was in 2012, there was a big meeting of various specialists to look at anaphylaxis in the United States. They documented very well that we don't treat anaphylaxis appropriately, and a series of articles came from that meeting. This was one of them. This is the reason I like the European guidelines. Why? Because if you look up here, it says first line. There is only one first line drug for anaphylaxis in the European guidelines. Give IM adrenaline. Everything else is a second line drug. I just like this particular graphic that they've produced. Now, the American Academy of Allergy, Asthma, and Immunology is part of the Choosing Wisely program. And as you know, we had five things physicians and patients should question, and then five more things. And so look at what the five more things are. Don't rely on antihistamines as a first-line treatment in severe allergic reactions. Don't perform IgE testing without a history consistent with potential IgE-mediated food allergy. Don't routinely order low or iso-osmolar radiocontrast media or pre-treat with corticosteroids and antihistamines for patients with a history of seafood allergy who require radiocontrast media. Don't routinely avoid influenza vaccination in egg allergic patients. And don't overuse non-beta-lactam antibiotics in patients with a history of penicillin allergy without an appropriate evaluation. Five more things, and each one of them, it's anaphylaxis, 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 and anaphylaxis. There is a focus on anaphylaxis. So now let's look at our 27-year-old known asthmatic who presents to your office with acute onset of hives, complaining of shortness of breath and racing heart after eating a peanut butter sandwich for lunch. He denies any known food allergy. He's wheezing and cannot speak in complete sentences. Your response: beta agonist, IM epinephrine, 50 milligrams of Benadryl, subcutaneous epinephrine, or ask him if he has his rescue inhaler and have him use it while you watch his technique. I teach. So these are our distractors in an asthmatic. In spite of the fact he's a known asthmatic, his presentation is consistent with anaphylaxis, not an asthma exacerbation. The nebulized beta agonist is a great adjunct therapy. Antihistamines might be an adjunct therapy. Subcutaneous epinephrine is a no-no. And rescue inhaler with observation, this is not the time to teach. So our group the group that met in 2012 and published in 2014 put together this clinical criteria for anaphylaxis. And what they said was, our definitions for anaphylaxis are so poor and so wide-ranging that you can't make sense of the anaphylaxis literature until we provide a consistent definition for anaphylaxis. And this is what they came up with. And frankly, I wish they would have done better, but this is what they came up with. So what they say is, if you have an unknown allergen and acute onset of illness, you need skin and mucosal involvement and either respiratory compromise or a drop in blood pressure. The second definition is, after exposure to a likely allergen, you need the rapid occurrence of two or more of the following. Again, skin and mucosal involvement, respiratory compromise, drop in blood pressure, and now we add persistent GI symptoms. And then their third definition is, after exposure to a known allergen, within minutes to hours, a rapid occurrence of a drop in blood pressure. And they made this table showing what the signs and symptoms are that we should look for anaphylaxis. And since every definition include skin or mucosal involvement, you see that urticaria angioedema in 88%, dyspnea and wheezing 47%, dizziness, syncope or hypotension in 33%, nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, cramping, abdominal pain in 30%, and then you see flush, upper airway edema are 46 and 56%, and then the rest drop quite a bit below that. If we have a reaction, one of the things that we need to be concerned about is a biphasic anaphylaxis or a biphasic allergy reaction. So what happens is, they come in, they're symptomatic, you treat them, they do well, they're doing fine, they appear to be all better, and then they recrudesce with their anaphylaxis and they have another episode. And really what you need to look at is that it's 25% of those who have fatal or near fatal reactions to food will have a biphasic reaction. And the time to the second reaction is typically about 8 hours, but it can be as long as 72 hours from the initial reaction. I have never seen one out that long. I've only read about this. It rarely occurs if it's not a severe anaphylaxis. So biphasic anaphylaxis rarely occurs without initial hypotension being a part of it. Common triggers: food, insect stings, medications. Less common are shown here. We sort of talked about that. Treatment is IM epinephrine. Now, our next patient is a 30-year-old, benign medical history, presents for a tetanus shot after stepping on a nail. Shortly after receiving his shot, he becomes pale, diaphoretic, and slowly slumps to the floor. Your nurse calls you for assistance. When you arrive, his skin is cold, clammy, pale, his pulse is 58, blood pressure is 130 over 76, He begins to arouse and says that he's lightheaded. What should we do for this patient? Give him epinephrine, 0.3 milligrams IM, start an IV, raise his legs, help him get to a chair, or give him our go-to diphenhydramine, 50 milligrams PO. This patient, we should raise his legs. This is a vasovagal reaction. It's a slow pulse, he's maintained his blood pressure, pale, cold, clammy skin, recumbency alleviates symptoms, and there's no urticaria and no pruritus. On one of the multiple recertification tests I've had to take, I had this test question, and I couldn't believe it was there. I went back like 3 times looking for what it was that I missed, what the hard thing was that I had missed. So you may see a question like this. And really what this is, the thing I want to show is, here's anaphylaxis, here's vasovagal, urticaria versus pale clammy skin, globus or a feeling that there's a lump in the back of my throat, I have trouble breathing, shortness of breath, wheezing, and a drop in SpO2, versus hyperventilation and an increase in SpO2, tachycardia versus bradycardia, hypotension versus normotensive. They both can have nausea, vomiting, diarrhea. One thing we didn't talk about with the signs of anaphylaxis is this feeling of impending doom, which we will often see as opposed to a bradycardia and lightheaded and confused. Now, our next patient is a little older. 63-year-old patient comes in with wheezing, urticaria, nausea, and he states he feels like he's gonna die. Your quick evaluation reveals an acutely ill patient. He's got flushing and urticaria. He can't speak in complete sentences. His blood pressure is 90 over 40. Heart rate's 120. You say, oh, I know what this is. This is anaphylaxis, and by golly, I know how to treat it. I'm going to give him 0.3 of epinephrine, IM, and continue to take a more detailed history. You also start an IV. The patient says, well, you know, I do have a history of anaphylaxis to bee stings when I was younger. I never had it evaluated. And he notes that he was stung shortly before his symptoms began. But he denies asthma, but he says he has high blood pressure. And he takes a beta blocker for his high blood pressure. After about 10 minutes, his symptoms are no better. So you give him a second IM injection of 0.3 milligrams of epinephrine. If he doesn't improve, where do we go next? Do we give him a fluid bolus? Do we repeat the epinephrine for a third time? Do we start an IV epinephrine drip? Do we give him nebulized beta agonist, or do we give him glucagon? Glucagon. But the trick about glucagon is they're not going to ask you this question. They're going to ask you how it's given or what the dose is. So if you have an anaphylaxis patient who's on a beta blocker refractory to epinephrine, consider glucagon. And you want to administer 1 milligram of glucagon, either IM or IV. And once you give it to them, you have to monitor glucose. So 1 milligram of glucagon, IM or IV. Patients who are receiving beta blockers have anaphylaxis of unusual severity. They can have profound hypotension, severe bronchospasm, severe angioedema that's refractory to the normal treatment. But you don't reach directly for glucagon. If it's not, I have a patient who has anaphylaxis who's presenting to me and is on a beta blocker, therefore I immediately give glucagon. You go through giving epinephrine first. So after 2 rounds of epinephrine, if they're still symptomatic, then you reach for glucagon. So we've already mentioned anaphylactoid reactions. Anaphylaxis versus anaphylactoid reaction is a discussion of mechanism, not clinical signs, symptoms, or treatments. Anaphylactoid reactions look like anaphylaxis, but they're not immunologically mediated. What this means is that it doesn't require prior sensitization. Bee sting anaphylaxis is IgE-mediated anaphylaxis. You need an exposure to bee stings so that you'll produce your IgE, and then on a second exposure, you'll have the reaction. An anaphylactoid reaction does not require that prior sensitization. So the reaction can occur on the very first exposure. Again, symptoms and treatment are the same as anaphylaxis. These are the 4 big areas of anaphylactoid reaction or non-IgE-mediated anaphylaxis-like symptoms that you need to know. Complement mediated, told you I like complement. Direct activation of mast cell mediator release, arachidonic acid metabolism, and unknown. If you give it a patient who's on dialysis and it has what appears to be anaphylaxis, this is probably complement mediated anaphylactoid reaction. So we see this with human plasma and blood products and with dialysis membranes. The one I think you'll see will be the direct activation of mast cell mediator release. The one that we talk about the most are opioids, but radiocontrast media also works through this direct mast cell mediator release, as does vancomycin, muscle depolarizing drugs, and aminoglycosides. So when we look at radiocontrast media specifically, we know that we have an increased risk of IV administration with high osmolality, We don't need to have a patient who's sensitized. The previous reaction does raise the probability of a repeat reaction, but is not required for a reaction. So what that means is, if you've had anaphylaxis or an anaphylactoid reaction to radiocontrast in the media in the past, you are more likely to have it again. We can use pretreatment to diminish the risk. And what's so important about anaphylactoid reactions is pretreatment will diminish the risk for anaphylactoid reactions. Pretreatment doesn't do as well in diminishing the risk of IgE-mediated anaphylaxis. If we look at modulators of arachidonic acid metabolism, here we find aspirin and nonsteroidal drugs. This is generally a more slow onset, but they can have profound bronchoconstriction that is very difficult to reverse. There won't be a question on aspirin desensitization. I don't think that will be involved, but it is possible. So when we look at the differential diagnosis of anaphylaxis, we need to think about a vasovagal reaction or a vasodepressor reaction. Another question that we see relatively often is stromboid fish poisoning. And what we see here is fish that is not appropriately cared for can have histidine form in the flesh of the fish. We eat the fish. The fish isn't bad. It's not food poisoning. We eat the fish. We convert histidine into histamine, and we have a stromboid fish problem. So it's a exposure to histidine in fish. We have to consider other forms of shock, other forms of overproduction of histamine, and red man syndrome.